He set down his empty beer glass and stepped off the stool. "I don't want another drink," he said. "Excuse me, I have to leave." He picked up his heavy suitcases. "You've been coming in here all this time," the owner said, "and we talked about that camp a lot, and you never told me you had a son in there. That wasn't right." He looked angry now. "Why wasn't it right?" "Hell, if I'd known, I wouldn't have said what I said. You're responsible, Norbert. You could have told me, but you deliberately didn't. I don't like that one bit." His face was red with indignation. Carrying his suitcases, Steiner left the bar. "This is not my day," he said aloud. "Argued with everybody. I'll have to spend the next visit here making apologies, if I come back at all. But I have to come back. My business depends on it. And I have to stop at Camp BG. There is no other way." Suddenly, it came to him that he should kill himself. The idea appeared in his mind full-blown, as if it had always been there, always a part of him. Easy to do it, just crash the copter. He thought, "I am goddamn tired of being Norbert Steiner. I didn't ask to be Norbert Steiner or sell black market food or anything else. What is my reason for staying alive? I'm not good with my hands. I can't fix or make anything. I can't use my mind either. I'm just a salesman. I'm tired of my wife's scorn because I can't keep our water machinery going. I'm tired of Otto, who I had to hire because I'm helpless even in my own business." In fact, he thought, why wait until I can get back to the copter? Along the street came a huge rumbling tractor bus, its sides dull with sand. It had crossed the desert just now, was coming to New Israel from some other settlement. Steiner set down his suitcases and ran out into the street, directly at the tractor bus. The bus honked, its air brakes screeched. Other traffic halted as Steiner ran forward with his head down, his eyes shut. Only at the last moment, with the sound of the air horn so loud in his ears that it became unbearably painful, did he open his eyes. He saw the driver of the bus gaping down at him, saw the steering wheel and the number on the driver's cap. And then... In the solarium at Camp Ben-Gurion, Miss Milch heard the sounds of sirens, and she paused in the middle of the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, which she was playing on the piano for the children to dance to. "Fire," one of the little boys said, going to the window. The other children followed. "No, it's an ambulance, Miss Milch," another boy said at the window, "going downtown." Miss Milch resumed playing, and the children, at the sound of the rhythms coming from the piano, straggled back to their places. They were bears at the zoo, cavorting for peanuts. That was what the music suggested to them. Miss Milch told them to go ahead and act it out. Off to one side, Manfred stood heedless of the music, his head down, a thoughtful expression on his face. As the sirens wailed up loudly for a moment, Manfred lifted his head. Noticing that, Miss Milch gasped and breathed a prayer. The boy had heard. She thumped away at the Tchaikovsky music even more loudly than before, feeling exaltation. She and the doctors had been right, for through sound there had come about a contact with the boy. Now Manfred went slowly to the window to look out. All alone, he gazed down at the buildings and streets below, searching for the origin of the noise which had aroused him, attracted his attention. "Things are not so hopeless after all," Miss Milch said to herself. "Wait until his father hears. It shows we must never talk of giving up." She played on, loudly and happily. Chapter 4 David Boland, building a dam of wet soil at the end of his family's vegetable garden under the hot mid-afternoon Martian sun, saw the UN police copter settle down and land before the Steiner's house, and he knew instantly that something was going on. A UN policeman in his blue uniform and shiny helmet stepped from the copter and walked up the path to the Steiner's front door, and when two of the little girls appeared, the policeman greeted them. He then spoke to Mrs. Steiner, and then he disappeared on inside, and the door shut after him. David got to his feet and hurried from the garden, across the stretch of sand, to the ditch. He leaped the ditch and crossed the patch of flat soil where Mrs. Steiner had tried unsuccessfully to raise pansies, and at the corner of the house he suddenly came upon one of the Steiner girls. She was standing, inertly, picking apart a stalk of worweed, her face white. She looked as if she were going to be sick. "Hey, what's wrong?" he asked her. "Why's the policeman talking to your mom?" The Steiner girl glanced at him and then bolted off, leaving him. "I'll bet I know what it is," David thought. "Mr. Steiner has been arrested because he did something illegal." He felt excited and he jumped up and down. I wonder what he did. Turning, he ran back the way he had come, hopped once more across the ditch of water, and at last threw open the door to his own house. Mom! He shouted, running from room to room. Hey, you know how you and Dad are always talking about Mr. Steiner being outside the law? I mean, in his work? Well, you know what? His mother was nowhere to be found. She must have gone visiting, he realized. For instance, Mrs. Hennessy, who lived within walking distance north along the ditch. Often, his mom was gone most of the day visiting other ladies, drinking coffee with them and exchanging gossip. Well, they're really missing out, David declared to himself. He ran to the window and looked out, to be sure of not missing anything. The policeman and Mrs. Steiner had gone outside now, and both were walking slowly to the police copter. Mrs. Steiner held a big handkerchief to her face, and the policeman had hold of her shoulder as if he was a relative or something. Fascinated, David watched the two of them get into the copter. The Steiner girls stood together in a small group, their faces peculiar. The policeman went over and spoke to them, and then he returned to the copter. And then he noticed David. He beckoned to him to come outdoors, and David, feeling fright, did so. He emerged from the house, blinking in the sunlight, and step by step approached the policeman with his shining helmet and his armband and the gun at his waist. "What's your name, son?" the policeman asked with an accent.
"David Bolin." His knees shook.
"Is mother or father home, David?"
"No," he said, "just me."
"When your parents return, you tell them to keep watch on the Steiner children, until Mrs. Steiner is back." The policeman turned up the motor of the copter, and the blades began to turn. "You do that, David? Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir," David said, noticing that the policeman had on the blue stripe, which meant he was Swedish.
The boy knew all the identifying marks which the different UN units wore. He wondered how fast the police copter could go. It looked like a special fast job, and he wished he could ride in it. He was no longer frightened of the policeman, and he wished they could talk more. But the policeman was leaving. The copter rose from the ground, and torrents of wind and sand blew around David, forcing him to turn away and put his arm across his face. The four Steiner girls stood gathered together, none of them speaking. One, the oldest, was crying. Tears ran down her cheeks, but she made no sound. The smallest, who was only three, smiled shyly at David.
"You want to help me with my dam?" David called to them. "You can come over. The policeman told me it was okay."
After a moment, the youngest Steiner girl came toward him, and then the others followed.
"What did your dad do?"
David asked the oldest girl. She was 12, older than he.
"The policeman said you could say," he added.
There was no answer. The girl merely stared at him.
"If you tell me," David said, "I won't tell anyone. I promise to keep it a secret."
Sunbathing out on June Hennessy's fenced and vined patio, sipping iced tea and drowsily conversing, Sylvia Bolin heard the radio from within the Hennessy house give the late afternoon news. Beside her, June raised herself up and said,
"Say, isn't that the man who lives next door to you?"
"Shh," Sylvia said, intently listening to the announcer. But there was no more, only the brief mention. Norbert Steiner, a dealer in health foods, had committed suicide on a downtown New Israel street by throwing himself in the path of a bus. It was the same Steiner, all right. It was their neighbor. She knew it at once.
"How dreadful," June said, sitting up and fastening the straps of her polka-dot cotton halter. "I only saw him a couple of times, but..."
"He was a dreadful little man," Sylvia said. "I'm not surprised he did it." And yet she felt horrified. She could not believe it. She got to her feet, saying, "With four children? He left her to take care of four children, isn't that dreadful? What's going to happen to them? They're so helpless, anyhow."
"I heard," June said, "that he deals on the black market. Have you heard that? Maybe they were closing in on him."
Sylvia said, "I better go home and see if there's anything I can do for Mrs. Steiner. Maybe I can take the children for a while." Could it have been my fault? She asked herself. Could he have done it because I refused him that water this morning? It could be because he was there. He had not gone to work yet.
So maybe it's our fault, she thought, the way we treated them. Which of us has ever really been nice to them and accepted them? But they are such dreadful whining people, always asking for help, begging and borrowing. Who could respect them?
Going into the house, she changed in the bedroom to her slacks and t-shirt. June Hennessy followed along with her.
"Yes,"
June said. You're right. We all have to pitch in and help where we can. I wonder if she'll stay on or if she'll go back to Earth. I'd go back. I'm practically ready to go back anyhow. It's so dull here.
Getting her purse and cigarettes, Sylvia said goodbye to June and set out on the walk back down the ditch to her own home. Breathless, she arrived in time to see the police copter disappearing into the sky. That was them notifying her, she decided. In the backyard, she found David with the four Steiner girls. They were busy playing.
Did they take Mrs. Steiner with them? She called to David.
The boy scrambled at once to his feet and came up to her excitedly.
Mom, she went along with them. I'm taking care of the girls.
That's what I was afraid of, Sylvia thought. The four girls still sat at the dam, playing a slow-motion, apathetic game with the mud and water, none of them looking up or greeting her. They seemed inert, no doubt from the shock of learning about their father's death. Only the smallest one showed any signs of reviving, and she probably had not comprehended the news in the first place. Already, Sylvia thought, that little man's death has reached out and touched others, and the coldness is spreading. She felt the chill in her own heart. And I did not even like him, she thought. The sight of the four Steiner girls made her quake. Am I going to have to take on these puddingy, plump, vapid, low-class children? She asked herself. The answering thought thrust its way up, tossing every other consideration aside. I don't want to. She felt panicked because it was obvious that she had no choice. Even now they were playing on her land, in her garden. She had them already. Hopefully, the smallest girl asked, Miss Bolin, could we have some more water for our dam? Water. Always wanting water, Sylvia thought. Always leeching on us, as if it was a trait born into them. She ignored the child and said instead to her son, Come into the house. I want to talk to you. Together, they went indoors where the girls could not overhear. David, she said, their father is dead. It came over the radio. That's why the police came and took her. We'll have to help out for a while. She tried to smile, but it was impossible. However much we may dislike the Steiners, David burst out, I don't dislike them, Mom. How come he died? Did he have a heart attack? Was he set on by Wild Bleakman? Could that be? It doesn't matter how he happened to die. What we have to think of now is what we can do for those girls. Her mind was empty. She could think of nothing. All she knew was that she did not want to have the girls near her. What should we do? She asked David. Maybe fix them lunch? They told me they didn't have any. She was just about to fix it. Sylvia went out from the house and down the path. I'm going to fix lunch, girls, for any of you who want it, over at your house. She waited a moment and then started toward the Steiner house. When she looked back, she saw that only the smallest child was following. The oldest girl said in a tear-choked voice, No, thank you. You'd better eat, Sylvia said, but she was relieved. Come along, she said to the little girl. What's your name?
Betty, the little girl said shyly. Could I have an egg sandwich and cocoa?
We'll see what there is, Sylvia said. Later, while the child ate her egg sandwich and drank her cocoa, Sylvia took the opportunity to explore the Steiner house. In the bedroom, she came upon something which interested her. A picture of a small boy with dark, enormous, luminous eyes and curly hair. He looked, Sylvia thought, like a despairing creature from some other world, some divine and yet dreadful place beyond their own. Carrying the picture into the kitchen, she asked little Betty who the boy was.
That's my brother Manfred,
Betty answered, her mouth full of egg and bread. Then she began to giggle. Between the giggles, a few hesitant words emerged, and Sylvia caught the fact that the girls were not supposed to mention their brother to anyone.
Why doesn't he live with you? Sylvia asked, full of curiosity.
He's at camp, Betty said, because he can't talk.
What a shame, Sylvia said. And she thought, at that camp in New Israel, no doubt. No wonder the girls aren't supposed to mention him. He's one of those anomalous children you hear of but never see. The thought made her sad. Unglimpsed tragedy in the Steiner household, she had never guessed. And it was in New Israel that Mr. Steiner had taken his life. Undoubtedly, he had been visiting his son. Then it has nothing to do with us, she decided, as she returned the picture to its place in the bedroom. Mr. Steiner's decision was based on a personal matter, so she felt relieved. Strange, she thought,
how one has the immediate reaction of guilt and responsibility when one hears of a suicide. If only I hadn't done this or had done that, I could have averted it. I'm at fault. And it was not so in this situation, not at all. She was a total outsider to the Steiners, sharing no part of their actual life, only imagining in a fit of neurotic guilt that she did so.
"Did you ever see your brother?" she asked Betty. "I think I saw him last year," Betty said hesitantly. "He was playing tag, and there were a lot of other boys bigger than me."
Now, silently, the three older Steiner girls filed into the kitchen and stood by the table. At last the eldest burst out, "We changed our mind. We would like lunch." "All right," Sylvia said. "You can help me crack the eggs and peel them. Why don't you go and get David, and I'll feed him at the same time. Wouldn't that be fun, to all eat together?" They nodded mutely. Walking up the main street of New Israel, Arnie Kott saw a crowd ahead, and cars pulled up to a halt at the curb, and he paused momentarily before turning in the direction of Ann Esterhazy's Contemporary Arts gift shop. "Something up," he said to himself. "Robbery? Street brawl?" However, he did not have time to investigate. He continued on his way and arrived presently at the small modern shop which his ex-wife ran. Hands in his trouser pockets, he sauntered in. "Anybody home?" he called jovially. No one there. She must have taken off to see the excitement, Arnie said to himself. Some business sense, didn't even lock up the store. A moment later, Anne came hurrying breathlessly back into the store. "Arnie," she said in surprise, seeing him.
"Oh, my God, do you know what happened? I was just talking to him, just talking, not more than an hour ago. And now he's dead."
Tears filled her eyes. She collapsed onto a chair, found a Kleenex, and blew her nose.
"It's just terrible," she said in a muffled voice. "And it wasn't an accident. He did it deliberately."
"Oh, so that's what's going on," Arnie said, wishing now that he had gone on and taken a look. "Who do you mean?"
"Oh, you wouldn't know him. He has a child at the camp. That's how I met him."
She rubbed her eyes and sat for a time while Arnie meandered about the store.
"Well," she said at last, "what can I do for you? It's nice to see you."
"My goddamn encoder broke down," Arnie said. "You know how hard it is to get decent repair service. What could I do but come by? What do you say to having lunch with me? Lock up the store a little while."
"Of course," she said distractedly. "Just let me go wash my face. I feel as if it was me. I saw him, Arnie. The bus rolled right over him. They have such mass, they just can't stop." "Oh, I would like some lunch. I want to get out of here."
She hurried into the washroom and closed the door. Soon afterwards, the two of them were walking up the sidewalk together.
"Why do people take their own lives?" Anne asked. "I kept thinking I could have prevented it. I sold him a flute for his boy. He still had the flute. I saw it with his suitcases on the curb. He never gave it to his son. Is that the reason? Something to do with the flute? I debated between the flute and..."
"Oh, cut it out," Arnie said. "It's not your fault. Listen, if a man is going to take his life, nothing can stop him. And you can't cause a person to do it. It's in his bloodstream. It's his destiny. They work themselves up to doing it years in advance, and then it's just like a sudden inspiration. All of a sudden, wham, they do it, see?" He wrapped his arm around her and patted her. She nodded. "Now, I mean, we've got a kid there at Camp BG, but it doesn't get us down," Arnie went on. "It's not the end of the world, right? We go on. Where do you want to eat? How's that place across the street, that Red Fox? Any good?" "I'd like some fried prawns, but hell, it's been almost a year since I saw them. This transportation problem has got to be licked or nobody is emigrating."
"Not the Red Fox," Anne said. "I loathe the man who runs it. Let's try that place on the corner. It's new. I haven't ever eaten in there. I hear it's supposed to be good."
As they sat at a table in the restaurant, waiting for their food to come, Arnie went on and developed his point. "One thing, when you hear about a suicide, you can be sure the guy knows this. He knows he's not a useful member of society. That's the real truth he's facing about himself. That's what does it, knowing you're not important to anybody. If there's one thing I'm sure of, it's that. It's nature's way. The expendable are removed by their own hand, too. So I don't lose any sleep when I hear of a suicide, and you'd be surprised how many so-called natural deaths here on Mars are actually suicides. I mean, this is a harsh environment. This place weeds out the fit from the unfit." Anne Esterhazy nodded, but did not seem cheered up.
Now this guy, Arnie continued.
Steiner, Anne said.
Steiner?
He stared at her.
Norbert Steiner? The black market operator?
His voice rose.
He sold health foods.
That's the guy!
He was flabbergasted.
Oh, no, not Steiner!
Good grief, he got all his goodies from Steiner. He was utterly dependent on the man. The waiter appeared with their food.
Oh, this is awful, Arnie said. I mean, really awful. What am I going to do?
Every party he threw, every time he had a cozy two-person dinner arranged for himself and some girl, for instance, Marty, or especially of late Doreen. Oh, it was just too goddamn much in one day, this and his encoder both together.
Don't you think, Anne said, it might have something to do with him being German? There's been so much sorrow in German since that drug plague, those children born with flippers. I've talked to some who said openly they thought it was God's punishment on them for what was done during the Nazi period. And these weren't religious men, these were businessmen, one of them here on Mars, the other at home.
That damn stupid Steiner, Arnie said. That cabbage head.
Eat your food, Arnie. She began to unfold her napkin. The soup looks good.
Oh, I can't eat, he said. I don't want this slop.
He pushed his soup bowl away.
You're still just like a big baby, Anne said, still having your tantrums.
Her voice was soft and compassionate.
Hell, he said, sometimes I feel like I've got the weight of the entire planet on me and you call me a baby.
He glared at her in baffled outrage.
I didn't know that Norbert Steiner was involved in the black market, Anne said.
Naturally you wouldn't, you and your lady committees. What do you know about the world around you? That's why I'm here. I read that last ad you had in the Times and it stank. You have to stop giving out that crap like you do. It repels intelligent people. It's just for other cranks like yourself.
Please, Anne said, eat your food, calm down.
I'm going to assign a man from my hall to look over your material before you distribute it, a professional.
Are you? She said mildly.
We've got a real problem. We're not getting the skilled people to come over from Earth anymore, the people we need. We're rotting. Everybody knows that. We're falling apart.
Smiling, Anne said, somebody will take Mr. Steiner's place. There must be other black market operators.
Arnie said, you're deliberately misunderstanding me so as to make me look greedy and small, whereas actually I'm one of the most responsible members of the entire colonization attempt here on Mars. And that's why our marriage broke down, because of your belittling me out of jealousy and competitiveness. I don't know why I came over here today. It's impossible for you to work things out on a rational basis. You have to inflict personalities into everything.
Did you know there's a bill before the UN to shut Camp BG? Anne said calmly.
No, Arnie said.
Does it distress you to think of BG being closed?
Hell, we'll give Sam private individual care.
What about the other children there?
You changed the subject, Arnie said.
Listen, Anne, you have to knuckle down to what you call masculine domination and let my people edit what you write. Honest to God, it does more harm than good. I hate to say this to your face, but it's the truth. You're a worse friend than you would be an enemy, the way you go about things. You're a dabbler, like most women. You're irresponsible.
He wheezed with wrath. Her face showed no reaction. What he said had no effect on her.
Can you bring any pressure to bear to help keep BG open? She asked. Maybe we can make a deal. I want to see it kept open.
A cause, Arnie said ferociously.
Yes.
You want my blunt answer?
She nodded, facing him coolly.
I've been sorry ever since those Jews opened that camp.
Anne said, bless you, honest blunt Arnie Cock, mankind's friend.
It tells the entire world we've got nuts here on Mars. That if you travel across space to get here, you're apt to damage your sexual organs and give birth to a monster that would make those German flipper people look like your next-door neighbor.
You and the gentleman who runs the Red Fox.
I'm just being hard-headedly realistic. We're in a struggle for our life. We've got to keep people emigrating here or we're dead on the vine, Anne. You know that. If we didn't have Camp BG, we could advertise that away from Earth's H-bomb testing contaminated atmosphere, there are no abnormal births. I hope to see that, but BG spoils it.
Not BG, the births themselves.
No one would be able to check up and show our abnormal births, Arnie said, without BG.
You'd say it, knowing it's not true if you could get away with it, telling them back home that they're safer here.
Sure, he nodded.
That's immoral.
No, listen, you're the immoral one. You and those other ladies, by keeping Camp BG open, you're...
Let's not argue. We'll never agree. Let's eat, and then you go on back to Lewistown. I can't take any more.
They ate their meal in silence. Dr. Milton Glaub, member of the psychiatric pool at Camp PG, on loan from the Interplan Truckers Union settlement, sat by himself in his office once more, back from BG, his stint there over for today. In his hands, he held a bill for roof repairs done on his home the month before. He had put off the work. It involved the use of the scraper, which kept the sand from piling up. But finally, the settlement building inspector had mailed him a 30-day condemnation notice. So he had contacted the roofing maintenance workers, knowing that he could not pay, but seeing no alternative. He was broke. This had been the worst month so far. If only Jean, his wife, could spend less. But the solution did not lie there anyhow. The solution was to acquire more patients. The ITU paid him a monthly salary, but for every patient he received an additional $50 bonus. Incentive, it was called. In actuality, it meant the difference between debt and solvency. Nobody with a wife and children could possibly live on the salary offered to psychiatrists, and the ITU, as everyone knew, was especially parsimonious. And yet Dr. Glaub continued to live in the ITU settlement. It was an orderly community, in some respects much like Earth. New Israel, like the other national settlements, had a charged explosive quality. As a matter of fact, Dr. Glaub had once lived in another national colony, the United Arab Republic one, a particularly opulent region in which much vegetation, imported from home, had been induced to grow. But to him, the settlers' constant animosity toward neighboring colonies had been first irritating and then appalling. Men at their daily jobs brooded over wrongs committed. The most charming individuals blew up when certain topics were mentioned. And at night, the hostility took practical shape. The national colonies lived for the night. Then the research labs, which were scenes of scientific experimentation and development during the day, were thrown open to the public and infernal machines were turned out. It was all done with much excitement and glee, and, of course, national pride. The hell with them, Dr. Glaub thought. Their lives were wasted. They had simply carried over the old quarrels from Earth. And the purpose of colonization had been forgotten. For instance, in the UN newspaper that morning, he had read about a fracas in the streets of the electrical workers' settlement. The newspaper account implied that the nearby Italian colony was responsible, since several of the aggressors had been wearing the long waxed mustaches popular in the Italian colony. A knock at his office door broke his line of thought. Yes, he said, putting the roofing bill away in a desk drawer. Are you ready for good member Purdy? His wife asked, opening the door in the professional manner that he had taught her. Send good member Purdy in, Dr. Glaub said. Wait a couple of minutes, though, so I can read over his case history. Did you eat lunch? Jean asked. Of course, everybody eats lunch. You look wan, she said. That's bad, Dr. Glaub thought. He went from his office into the bathroom, where he carefully darkened his face with the caramel-colored powder currently in fashion. It did improve his looks, although not his state of mind. The theory behind the powder was that the ruling circles in the ITU were of Spanish and Puerto Rican ancestry, and they were apt to feel intimidated if a hired person had skin lighter than their own. Of course, the ads did not put it like that. The ads merely pointed out to hired men in the settlement that the Martian climate tends to allow natural skin tone to fade to unsightly white. It was now time to see his patient. Good afternoon, good member Purdy.
Afternoon, Doc.
I see from your file that you're a baker.
Yeah, that's right.
A pause. What did you wish to consult with me about?
Good member Purdy, staring at the floor and fooling with his cap, said,
I never been to a psychiatrist before.
No, I can see here that you haven't.
There's this party my brother-in-law's giving. I'm not much on going to parties.
Are you compelled to attend? Dr. Glaub had quietly set the clock on his desk. It ticked away the good member's half hour.
They're sort of throwing it for me. They want me to take on my nephew as an apprentice so he'll be in the union eventually.
Purdy droned on.
And I've been lying awake at night trying to figure out how to get out of it. I mean, these are my relatives, and I can't hardly come out and tell them no. But I just can't go. I don't feel good enough to. So that's why I'm here.
I see, Dr. Glaub said. Well, you'd better give me the particulars on this party, when and where it is, the names of the persons involved, so I can do a right bang-up job while I'm there. With relief, Purdy dug into his coat pocket and brought out a neatly typed document.
I sure appreciate you going in my place, Doc. You psychiatrists really take a load off a man's back. I'm not joking when I say I've been losing sleep over this.
He gazed with grateful awe at the man before him, skilled in the social graces, capable of treading the narrow, hazardous path of complex interpersonal relations which had defeated so many union members over the years. Don't worry any further about it, Dr. Glaub said. For after all, he thought, what's a little schizophrenia? That is, you know, what you're suffering from. I'll take the social pressure from you, and you can continue in your chronic maladaptive state, at least for another few months, until the next overpowering social demand is made on your limited capabilities. As good member Purdy left the office, Dr. Glaub reflected that this certainly was a practical form of psychotherapy which had evolved here on Mars. Instead of curing the patient of his phobias, one became, in the manner of a lawyer, the actual advocate in the man's place at... Jean called into the office. Milt, there's a call for you from New Israel. It's Bosley Tuvim. Oh, God, Dr. Glaub thought. Tuvim was the president of New Israel. Something was wrong. Hurriedly, he picked up the phone on his desk. Dr. Glaub here?
Doctor,
sounded the dark, stern, powerful voice. This is Tuvim. We have a death here, a patient of yours, I understand. Will you kindly fly back here and attend to this? Allow me to give you a few token details. Norbert Steiner, a West German...
He's not my patient, sir, Dr. Glaub interrupted. However, his son is. A little autistic child at Camp BG.
What do you mean Steiner is dead? For heaven's sake, I was just talking to him this morning. Are you sure it's the same Steiner? If it is, I do have a file on him, on the entire family, because of the nature of the boy's illness. In child autism, we feel that the family situation must be understood before therapy can begin. Yes, I'll be right over.
Tuvim said, this is evidently a suicide.
I can't believe it, Dr. Glaub said.
For the past half hour, I have been discussing this with the staff at Camp BG. They tell me you had a long conversation with Steiner shortly before he left the camp. At the inquest, our police will want to know what indications, if any, Steiner gave of a depressed or morbidly introspective mood. What he said that might have given you the opportunity to dissuade him, or, barring that, compel him to undergo therapy.
I take it the man said nothing that would alert you to his intentions.
Absolutely nothing, Dr. Glaub said.
Then if I were you, I wouldn't worry, Tuvim said. Merely be prepared to give the clinical background of the man. Discuss possible motives which might have led him to take his life, you understand.
Thank you, Mr. Tuvim, Dr. Glaub said weakly. I suppose it is possible he was depressed about his son, but I outlined a new therapy to him. We have very high hopes for it. However, he did seem cynical and shut in. He did not respond as I would have expected. But suicide?
What if I lose the BG assignment? Dr. Glaub was asking himself. I just can't. Working there once a week added enough to his income so that he could imagine, although not attain, financial security. The BG check at least made the goal plausible. Didn't it occur to that idiot Steiner what effect his death might have on others? Yes, it must have. He did it to get vengeance on us. Paying us back. But for what? For trying to heal his child? This is a very serious matter, he realized. A suicide so close on the heels of a doctor-patient interview. Thank God Mr. Tuvim warned me. Even so, the newspapers will pick it up, and all those who want to see Camp BG closed will benefit from this. Having repaired the refrigeration equipment at McAuliffe's Dairy Ranch, Jack Bolin returned to his copter, put his toolbox behind the seat, and contacted his employer, Mr. Yee.
The school, Mr. Yee said. You must go there, Jack. I still have no one else to take that assignment.
Okay, Mr. Yee. He started up the motor of the copter, feeling resigned to it.
A message from your wife, Jack.
Oh? He was surprised. His employer frowned on wives of his employees phoning in, and Sylvia knew that. Maybe something had happened to David.
Can you tell me what she said? He asked.
Mr. Yee said,
Mrs. Bolin asked our switchboard girl to inform you that a neighbor of yours, a Mr. Steiner, has taken his own life.
Mrs. Boland is caring for the Steiner children, she wants you to know. She also asked if it was possible for you to come home tonight, but I told her that although we regretted it, we could not spare you. You must stay available on call until the end of the week, Jack.
Steiner dead, Jack said to himself. The poor ineffectual sap. Well, maybe he's better off.
Thank you, Mr. Yee, he said into the microphone.
As the copter lifted from the sparse grass of the pasture, Jack thought, this is going to affect all of us, and deeply. It was a strong and acute feeling, an intuition. I don't believe I ever exchanged more than a dozen words with Steiner at any one time, and yet there is something enormous about the dead. Death itself has such authority. A transformation as awesome as life itself, and so much harder for us to understand.
He turned the copter in the direction of the UN headquarters on Mars, on his way to the great self-winding entity of their lives, the unique artificial organism which was their public school, a place he feared more than any other in his experience away from home.
Chapter 5.
Why was it that the public school unnerved him? Scrutinizing it from above, he saw the duck-egg-shaped building, white against the dark, blurred surface of the planet, apparently dropped there in haste. It did not fit into its surroundings. As he parked in the paved lot at the entrance, he discovered that the tips of his fingers had whitened and lost feeling, a sign familiar to him that he was under tension. And yet this place did not bother David, who was picked up and flown here 3 days a week, along with other children of his achievement group. Evidently it was some factor in his own personal makeup. Perhaps because his knowledge of machines was so great, he could not accept the illusion of the school, could not play the game. For him, the artifacts of the school were neither inert nor alive. They were in some way both. Soon he sat in a waiting room, his toolbox beside him. From a magazine rack he took a copy of Motor World and heard, with his trained ears, a switch click. The school had noted his presence. It noted which magazine he selected, how long he sat reading, what he took next. It measured him. A door opened, and a middle-aged woman wearing a tweed suit, smiling at him, said, "You must be Mr. Yee's repairman."
"Yes," he said, standing.
"So glad to see you." She beckoned him to follow her. "There's been so much fuss about this one teacher, but it is at the output stage."
Striding down a corridor, she held the door open for him as he caught up.
"The angry janitor," she said, pointing.
He recognized it from his son's description.
"It broke down suddenly," the woman was saying in his ear. "See? Right in the middle of its cycle. It had gone down the street and shouted, and then it was just about to wave its fist."
"Doesn't the master circuit know?"
"I am the master circuit," the middle-aged woman said, smiling at him cheerfully, her steel-rimmed glasses bright with the sparkle in her eyes.
"Of course," he said, chagrined.
"We think it might be this," the woman, or rather this peripatetic extension of the school, said, holding out a folded paper. Unwadding it, he found a diagrammed congeries of self-regulating feedback valves. "This is an authority figure, isn't it?" he said. "Teaches the child to respect property. Very righteous type, as the teachers go."
"Yes," the woman said.
Manually, he reset the angry janitor and restarted it. After clicking for a few moments, it turned red in the face, raised its arm, and shouted, "You boys keep out of here, you understand?"
Watching the whiskery jowls tremble with indignation, the mouth open and shut, Jack Boland could imagine the powerful effect it would have on a child. His own reaction was one of dislike. However, this construct was the essence of the successful teaching machine. It did a good job in conjunction with 24 other constructs placed, like booths in an amusement park, here and there along the corridors which made up the school. He could see the next teaching machine just around the corner. Several children stood respectfully in front of it as it delivered its harangue.
"And then I thought," it was telling them in an affable, informal voice, "my gosh, what is it we folks can learn from an experience like that? Do any of you know? You, Sally."
A small girl's voice.
Well, maybe we can learn that there is some good in everybody, no matter how bad they act."
"What do you say, Victor?" the teaching machine bumbled on. "Let's hear from Victor Plank."
A boy stammered.
I'd say about what Sally said, that most people are really good underneath if you take the trouble to really look. Is that right, Mr. Whitlock?"
So Jack was overhearing the Whitlock teaching machine. His son had spoken of it many times. It was a favorite of his. As he got out his tools, Jack listened to it. The Whitlock was an elderly, white-haired gentleman with a regional accent, perhaps that of Kansas. He was kindly, and he let others express themselves. He was a permissive variety of teaching machine, with none of the gruffness and authoritarian manner of the angry janitor. He was, in fact, as near as Jack could tell, a combination of Socrates and Dwight D. Eisenhower.
"Sheep are funny," the Whitlock said. "Now you look at how they behave when you throw some grub over the fence to them, such as corn stalks. Why, they'll spot that from a mile away."
The Whitlock chuckled.
"They're smart when it comes to what concerns them. And maybe that helps us see what true smartness is. It isn't having read a lot of books or knowing long words. It's being able to spot what's to our advantage. It's got to be useful to be real smartness."
Kneeling down, Jack began unscrewing the back from the angry janitor. The master circuit of the school stood watching. This machine, he knew, went through its song and dance in response to a reel of instruction tape, but its performance was open to modification at each stage, depending on the behavior of its audience. It was not a closed system. It compared the children's answers with its own tape, then matched, classified, and at last responded. There was no room for a unique answer, because the teaching machine could recognize only a limited number of categories. And yet it gave a convincing illusion of being alive and viable. It was a triumph of engineering. Its advantage over a human teacher lay in its capacity to deal with each child individually. It tutored rather than merely teaching. A teaching machine could handle up to 1,000 pupils and yet never confuse one with the next. With each child, its responses altered so that it became a subtly different entity. Mechanical, yes, but almost infinitely complex. The teaching machines demonstrated a fact that Jack Bolin was well aware of. There was an astonishing depth to the so-called artificial. And yet he felt repelled by the teaching machines, for the entire public school was geared to a task which went contrary to his grain. The school was there not to inform or educate, but to mold, and along severely limited lines. It was the link to their inherited culture, and it peddled that culture in its entirety to the young. It bent its pupils to it. Perpetuation of the culture was the goal, and any special quirks in the children which might lead them in another direction had to be ironed out. It was a battle, Jack realized, between the composite psyche of the school and the individual psyches of the children, and the former held all the key cards. A child who did not properly respond was assumed to be autistic, that is, oriented according to a subjective factor that took precedence over his sense of objective reality. And that child wound up by being expelled from the school. He went, after that, to another sort of school entirely, one designed to rehabilitate him. He went to Camp Ben-Gurion. He could not be taught. He could only be dealt with as ill. Autism, Jack reflected as he unscrewed the back of the angry janitor, had become a self-serving concept for the authorities who governed Mars. It replaced the older term psychopath, which in its time had replaced moral imbecile, which had replaced criminally insane. And at Camp BG, the child had a human teacher, or rather, therapist. Ever since his own son David had entered the public school, Jack had waited to hear the bad news, that the boy could not be graded along the scale of achievement by which the teaching machines classified their pupils.